Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? You get what you need. Oh. I got an interesting email this week
from somebody who said, Carol, you know, there are so many treatment centers out there and treatment modalities. What do you think is the best for treating sexual addiction? And I got to tell you, there is not one answer. You really have to explore what fits your best needs. For instance, I'm in the Midwest. I'm in Indianapolis. So if I got a client who is really budget conscious and they can only spend a certain amount of money, I'm going to refer them to some really good treatment centers here in the Midwest so that they can drive there. And that's going to cut out, you know, anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 in airfare. And then I'm going to pick most definitely the treatment centers that are the most affordable. Now, I also believe there are treatment centers that are premier treatment centers. They have the most incredible staff, but they typically are 2 to 3 times more expensive than the average treatment center. So it kind of depends on what experience you want. Now, when it comes to individual therapists, you know that I only recommend certified sexual addictions therapists. That's CSATs, C-S-A-T-S. And they are actually trained by ITAP, the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals. That is Patrick Carnes' group. There are some other very reliable treatment modalities out there for orienting therapists to sex addiction and problematic behavior, like SASH. And I don't know much about their program, but I do know their organization is excellent. But I'm partial to the one I went to, so I'm going to advocate for them. And then if you want help for your partner, or if you're a partner wanting help for yourself, you all know that I am absolutely positively biased towards APSATS, A-P-S-A-T-S. And that is, the partner specialists that specifically work with the trauma that a partner experiences when she finds out that her partner is a sex addict. I mean, that is very, very traumatic. It involves partner betrayal. And partner betrayal is by far the worst type of betrayal out there. And so I am a believer in getting with people that understand the dynamics behind that. And so those are the two organizations that I really recommend. Thank you for your email. I'm glad that you asked. Now, you may ask yourself, where can I get free resources? You know, there are many, many, many free resources out there. I interview a lot of people that give you lots of free resources. So you've got to tune into my show and find out who those people are. But I highly recommend my YouTube channel. It's Sex Help with Carol the Coach. And I have over 50 videos for partners and for sex addicts on how to get healthier. And I have blogs. I have blogs on sexhelp.com. I have blogs on AppSats. I have blogs on my own website, Sex Help with Carol the Coach. Lots of good information that's done in very easy, doable, readable, understandable blogs. Because, you know, one of the things I know, I was just reading a research article, and we're talking about how if you have autism, you're much more likely to have sex addiction because of the way your brain operates. It's very repetitive. You go back to it over and over and over again. You're socially isolated. But the research studies were so complex that I thought, boy, this is not anything that I could refer my listeners to. Not that I think my listeners are intellectually challenged by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, one of the things I'm always amazed at is how well-versed you are in knowledge about sexual addiction and partner trauma. But what I do believe is it makes more sense to be able to read it without having to reread it and reread it. Speaking about reading, tonight I have Joshua Shea. He's the author of The Addiction Nobody Will Talk About, How My Pornography Addiction Hurt People and Destroyed Relationships. And, you know, I'm telling you, this is a guy who seemingly had it all. He had a loving wife, two children, a supportive extended family. And just about 7 years ago, he launched the Lifestyle magazine in his hometown. Within 1 year, he was one of the founders of Central Maine's largest film festival and had won a seat on his city council. So this guy was really moving and shaking, and he was making a difference in his community. He had received the key to the city and was being called one of the next 10 people shaping Maine's economy. Wow, there were a lot of things working in his favor. However, while the public got one picture of Shea, behind closed doors, his longtime mental health and addiction issues were festering. He was a workaholic by nature, and you know, I always say, when you got one addiction, you probably have two or three, and some of them may be what other people would consider very valuable, like workaholism. So Joshua Shea was a workaholic, and he had actively ignored the red flags surrounding his long-existing pornography and alcohol problems. He was finding it easier to lose himself in a bottle of tequila and adult websites than actually dealing with his issues. So, of course, when you combine workaholism, alcohol, and sex addiction, you got the trifecta. This is going to be a problem. Shea's relationships with his family, his colleagues, and his friends grew distant. His business ventures began to collapse, And his life came to a screeching halt when he was arrested on a charge of underage pornography possession in 2014. Okay, so in 2010, he was considered one of the next 10 people shaping Maine's economy. 4 years later, he was arrested on porn possession, child porn. And then he was convicted and he served 6 months in jail in 2016. So what do you do when you've lost it all and life does not seem like it's going to get any better? Well, if you're ready to make a lifetime change, you decide, how can I make a difference in my own life and in the world? And that's what he did. Following his arrest, he sought help. He got intensive treatment. He did one-on-one therapy, group therapy. He went to inpatient. And he has been sober for 4 years, and he's written this book. Again, it's called The Addiction Nobody Will Talk About, How My Pornography Addiction Hurt People and Destroyed Relationships. He was bothered by the lack of quality resources and open discussion around the topic of porn addiction. So he has made it his mission to talk about his addiction because he, like I, believe that when you talk about it, and when you help others, you know, when you've experienced that suffering and you decide to have a transformation and you give back, that is the new trifecta for wonderful things to occur. He's going to be talking to us tonight about the last several years of his life and kind of the poor judgment and decision-making he made. And how he's kind of pulled himself out of it. Again, the addiction nobody will talk about. And I'm looking so forward to talking with him because here's what I know to be true. This is why I do the work I do. So many people see that sex addiction has a stigma that means that, you know, you're kind of at the bottom of the barrel of society. You're doing things you shouldn't do. It's dark and evil. You know, people don't talk about sex anyway, healthy sexuality, let alone when somebody's veered off the wrong track. You know, they're looking at child porn. They're involved in activities where they exploit others. They get exploited. And as a result, I want to make this a talkable situation so that people can decide for themselves what is right or wrong, what works for them and what doesn't. Being a sexual health advocate, believer in, if there's sexuality that doesn't really hurt you, if it doesn't seem to hurt anybody else, it may not be a problem. And yet what I know to be true, and, you know, I'm in my early 60s, is that more often times than not, sexuality that exploits another person, even if it's in the porn industry, is not healthy. So I, myself, personally, I divert from what many therapists think, which is that pornography is okay. And I'm not against what they think. They can have their opinion, and I will have mine. But what I know to be true is that any time that there are people that are moving into pornography, exploitive pornography, and they're moving away from their own healthy relationships, it does nothing for intimacy and their own relationships. So that is why I don't advocate porn of any sort, but I certainly feel like you more than likely have the ability to know, is it right or wrong for you? And I'm going to leave it to that. So I really want to encourage you to listen to Joshua's story and then compare it to your own. No matter where you're at, we can all see some distinct similarities in his story and yours. Joshua Shea, welcome to the Sex Help with Carol the Coach Show.
Thank you so much for having me tonight, Carol. I appreciate it.
Well, yes, and your story is riveting. You can tell that you are a born educator. Tell us a little bit about your life and what got you to this point where you decided, I need to share my story.
Well, geez, it's such a long story. That's why I put it into a book, I guess. In a nutshell, as you mentioned a few moments ago, I was dealing with a whole bunch of addictions, including porn addiction, alcoholism, workaholism. I had issues with mental health as well. And I was so lucky to have the resources and the ability to get some really great help after I ended up being arrested. It was nearly 2 years between the time I was arrested and the time that I was sentenced. The legal system works incredibly slow. During this time, I went to two inpatient rehab centers, one for alcoholism, one for sex addiction. I did all of that one-on-one and group therapy, like you mentioned. And I had this idea that, you know, it was so powerful sharing my stories with other people who had these problems. When we'd get together in our groups in rehab or back here in Maine. But the place that really drove home the point that I should start telling this story was when I was in jail. And because I was so well known in Maine prior to getting into jail, the newspaper ran some stories of the fact that I was sentenced and heading in there immediately upon entering. There were inmates who were there for reasons that had nothing to do with sex or porn. Most people there were awaiting hearings on domestic violence or probation violations with drugs or whatnot, but they would come to me off to the side and start asking questions about sex addiction, start asking questions about porn addiction. And it really, you know, was sad because so many of them didn't have the resources to go to a rehabilitation center out of state, or they didn't even know where to go locally to start talking about things. You know, they could find an AA meeting, but they didn't know where to go for a Sex Addicts Anonymous meeting or a Sexaholics meeting. So it was there in talking to a lot of these people that I decided, you know, I think what I need to do is write my story down, and not write a story that is necessarily self-help, not write a story that's necessarily full of statistics, and I can quote both ad nauseum to you, but really just talk about myself and talk about the way that I imploded and hope that the book can really serve two purposes. One, as a mirror for those who are in the early stages of addiction or maybe in the ongoing stages, to see my story and recognize that if you don't get help, like any other addiction, it's going to escalate. And in my case, it escalated to a criminal place, as many addictions do. The other reason I wrote the story was to really try to get through to people who don't know anything about addiction, specifically porn addiction. And so they can see that there is no stereotype when you come to an addiction like this. I've met doctors and lawyers and teachers and every, you know, man, woman, every age, walk of life who suffers with this. And I think that that needs to come more to the forefront. It's not, you know, perverted 20-year-old guys in their mom's basement who have never kissed a girl in real life. This is something that we all have or that every type of person could have. And getting that out there is, I think, is really important, especially where we are right now in society.
I highly agree with everything you've just said, and what I know to be true is that porn addiction is in itself a sex addiction, but it's also a gateway for other addictions. And so one of the things that I loved about your book and I love about your mission is that you're really there to help anybody with any income, all resources. I mean, you and I both know that it can happen to anybody. So can you tell us a little bit about How did your life evolve into this porn addiction? What happened? Because you were a workaholic, and gosh, you were named one of the 10 top people in Maine for the economy. I mean, it looked like you had it all. So give us a little bit of background
to the outside,
about you.
Yeah, and to the people on the outside, it absolutely looked like I did. But from a very young age, I mean, my story is in some ways your paint-by-numbers story when it comes to addiction. There was a fair amount of trauma at the hands of a babysitter I had when I was young, who my parents would leave me with when they went off to work. And for several years, I had to deal with physical, mental, and sexual I hate to use the word abuse because I've met people who have been abused so much worse than I was, but some very inappropriate situations, some very unhealthy situations that I was put into or that I witnessed other children being put into. I think that was where some of the formula started right off the bat. I can't explain it, but the first time that my cousin exposed me to hardcore pornography and I was 10 or 11 years old, I knew I discovered something very special. It was very similar the way that when I first got drunk 4 years later, 4 or 5 years later, I knew that I had just found some kind of massive coping mechanism that would stay with me for life and that could be a go-to. Yeah, and I didn't know anything about addiction being a kid, but I just knew I discovered something. And it stayed with me through life. And there were times where I very rarely had to utilize pornography at all. When I was, you know, actively dating or when I was in the early years of my marriage, it didn't rear its ugly head. And the same thing was true for my other addictions. They would come in and go out over 20 years. What really brought everything to a head was 3-4 years after starting my magazine, and the magazine took off like wildfire. Never could have imagined how popular it would be and how it would thrust me to the forefront of people's minds as quickly as it did. But as new shiny things tend to become after a few years, it wasn't that special anymore. And I am not a great businessman. I'm a writer and editor by trade. At the beginning, we had a ton of money coming in and not a lot of expenses. 4 years later, we started to plateau with our revenue and our expenses kept growing. And I didn't have the skill set to take care of this. So I fell back onto my addictions and started to drink harder and use more porn than I ever had. I couldn't turn around my company's fortunes, and ultimately, I just thought, you know, I was diagnosed bipolar in my mid-20s. You know, I remember that intense amount of energy that I used to have when I wasn't taking my psych meds. Maybe if I took myself off of my meds, I could tap into that manic side that when I was 22 years old would let me stay up 20, 21 hours a night, where I never felt tired, where I had constant creative juices going, where everything was great. And that's just the fallacy of nostalgia. Because I pulled myself off of my pills. And I think that was the I don't want to say beginning of the end. I think that was the end of the beginning. I think that it didn't have the result that I hoped for. It didn't save the company. Mm-hmm. All it did was make me turn more toward alcohol and porn as crutches for coping with anxiety, for coping with the stress of a failing business. My relationship with my wife and my kids was failing because I was spending so much time at work trying to save this thing and trying to run my film festival and political career. And it was really one of these things that just kept imploding and imploding, and I needed more alcohol and I needed more porn. Eventually, I made the move from watching videos online to talking to women in chat rooms. And I very quickly learned how to work the software that was used, so nobody would see me on a webcam, but I could see them. What they would see is a video of a good-looking guy who, you know, had a lot, who, you know, he sounded just like me because it was me doing the typing, but he was a much prettier version of me. And I was able to convince women by gaining their trust. You're absolutely typical kind of grooming to engage in sexual behavior online. And one of the things that I would do at the end, because as my life was imploding and as trophy collecting was a hugely important way for me to validate myself, I would take a screen capture when I successfully got a woman to take off her clothes or perform sexually online for me. Take a couple screen captures, throw it into a folder, and come back the next night and do it all over again and hopefully be successful. And that was really all about power. I didn't use those screen captures I took. I didn't use them for sexual gratification because I had the whole rest of the internet to use for that. This was my little niche of, even though I was losing power within my family, I was losing power at the workplace, I couldn't together, it seemed like the world was against me. Those 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the night when I was talking to women online, that's when I could exercise power, and I needed a trophy to show it. Unfortunately,
and it was anonymous, it was affordable, and it was accessible. You could do it really without anybody knowing what was going on.
Absolutely, because like I said, most people, when they're using these, it's they see the person on the other end, the person on the other end sees them, but I was taught essentially how to bypass my webcam and find a video that could fool people. So they were seeing, instead of seeing a guy in his late 30s whose life was crashing, they saw this good-looking buff guy in his early 20s. And I was, you know, and since they didn't see me, I was on one part of my computer screen. Anytime a woman would give me a little bit of information that they probably didn't think was very important, I could be doing my investigative searches on the internet. And I have a background as a reporter, and I'm very good at reading people. You know, I'm an addict. I'm a liar and a manipulator by trade. I knew how to work people, so I could get them to do what I wanted. And unfortunately, after several months of doing this, my body and my mind kept deteriorating to the point where I, as long as she looked old enough, that was good enough for me. That was really my only criteria. Unfortunately, looks can deceive. Looks can absolutely deceive, and I know this, but I didn't let it bother me. And I unfortunately ended up talking to a teenage girl. A few months after that happened, I, you know, didn't think of it. It was a one-off kind of thing. A few months later, the Maine State Police showed up at my door with a search warrant for my computers, and we were off to the races there. I lost my job, you know, immediately. My co-owners of the magazine fired me that day. I spent that day that I was arrested dodging TV cameras at my house because their vans would show up every hour or two. It was a hectically crazy time, but it was the best thing that ever could have happened for my health.
To your story, I'm sitting there thinking, I get that you had to be absolutely in shock and yet in denial, in hypervigilance. I mean, when you are exposed like that, all of a sudden, your body goes into overdrive. And then I'm thinking about your wife and kids and how they probably didn't have even a clue that you were living this dual life.
My wife knew that I used, or that I had viewed pornography online, and she didn't have a huge problem with it in the past because I think she thought it was a once in a while kind of thing. That
like
was,
any woman do.
Well, yeah, like you know, it's and like I think a lot of guys actually probably do utilize it as a once in a while release. And I she didn't have any giant moral opposition to pornography as a as an entity, and she just didn't know. She had no idea where it went in those last that last year or two, as it became something that really almost sustained me to like the alcohol to allow me to keep going.
Now let me ask you something, because I talk to my listeners about pornography either being arousing, it brought you that intensity and that feeling of taboo, what else is out there, that excitement, that rush, that dopamine hit, or it brings you into a numbing experience where you just kind of zone out and you numb out, and all that time distortion occurs when you're numbing and medicating. Or last but not least, it activates that fantasy part of the brain where you're actually living a life that is not the life you're living. Of those three criteria, which one do you think was your primary fixation?
I would say that largely depends where I was in the illness. For many, many years, it was a physical release, and then I think it before it became ultra critical, I think it became a lot about fantasy. Of escaping to a different life, of recognizing I'm in my late 30s, and there were a lot of boats of sexual exploration that have sailed, and the only way I was ever going to get to experience any of them was through pornography. But at the very end, it was just about numbing. It really wasn't even about pleasure. My self-gratification wasn't really even that much of a part of the ritual or routine in the last 6-8 months. It was about control and about power, and it wasn't the reasons that the 15-year-old me started to get into it or would rent porno videos a couple times a week. It was really almost a life-sustaining thing, or that's how I saw it at the very end. It was medicine. It was the same reason I drank. I needed it to cope with the reality of the real world.
Well, and you referenced, obviously, mental health issues. And so do you mind sharing with our listening audience your actual mental health diagnosis?
Oh, not at all. In my early 20s, I took a very, very hard hit when my best friend was killed by a drunk driver. And I started to see a therapist at that point, and we started to get into some issues, and it was very clear that I had issues with anxiety. So for a couple of years, I wasn't on many meds, but he diagnosed me with a generalized anxiety disorder. Life kept getting more difficult for me. I'd have episodes that just didn't make a lot of sense to me. And it was finally my regular physician, who had known me since I was, a kid, who said, who had witnessed me, rise up in journalism at that point. And he said, I think that you really should look into a bipolar diagnosis. I've just known you so long, and I think this might fit. When he gave me some material about it, it fit like a glove. I had never seen anything that so perfectly described me. And not just the way that I felt, but like behaviors of somebody who was suffering from bipolar. Because the fact was, I only knew things were wrong when I was depressed. I didn't recognize the mania was a whole problem unto itself, because the mania was my normal. The mania was my normal. The depression, which would happen maybe a week of the month or maybe 2 months of the year, that was the abnormal piece that I was trying to get taken care of, not recognizing the mania was an issue. So in my mid-20s, I was diagnosed with bipolar. As I was going through the recovery process between my arrest and my sentencing, I had a medical professional in California, the first person that I saw who was a certified sex addiction therapist, He was the first one who floated the idea of PTSD to me. And as I learned, I thought that was just something that people got when they came home from Iraq from fighting in the war. But as I did more research and started to do a lot of work with one specific therapist back here in Maine, that seemed to really fit a lot of my a lot of the feelings and trauma that I had dating back to being a young kid, dealing with that hellish house that I was in with that babysitter. So PTSD and bipolar are the two big ones. My therapist and I have been talking a bit about some narcissistic personality disorder tendencies that I have in the last couple months. She doesn't quite diagnose me with it yet. But
yeah, narcissism actually comes out of being wounded, and you were wounded early on in your life. So that narcissism helped to provide that guard, if you will, that wall that said, I am all this, and you can't hurt me anymore.
Right, right, absolutely. And what's interesting is right now I'm going through this process of promoting this book and sharing my story again and again and again. And it's interesting in seeing some of my very instinctive reactions to what's going on. You know, just little things like when I get, I haven't received any bad reviews for the book yet, but I've received some middle of the road reviews, and, you know, that tweaks my little inability to handle, you know, criticism. And, you know, I put out this book and I want people to love it because I have this need for admiration. You know, I have these fantasies of being a super successful author, and, you know, almost, and I have to stop and reckon, you know what, I'm not entitled to anything. I'm not superior to any other author. I'm these natural things that come out of me now that before I would act on and just run with. Thankfully now I've been through so much therapy in the last couple of years that I can stop and really do what cognitive behavioral therapy is supposed to do for you, which is cause you to stop and look at your actions and analyze them and figure out why you're thinking the way you are, why you're behaving the way you are, what your next steps are going to be. And I think in doing some research and learning about narcissistic personality disorder, it's one of these things that most therapists don't diagnose quickly because they really have to get to know you as a patient and understand you before they can attach this diagnosis to you. And I can really see how 5-6 years ago, if somebody had introduced this idea to me that I had a narcissist problem, I would have laughed in their face and just said, no, it's just because I'm that much better than you. You know, that's what the problem is. But thankfully, through this process of recovery, I'm open to new ideas. I'm open to diagnosis. I'm open to looking myself in. And for the first time in, you know, the first 35, 36 years of my life, I would not listen to criticism. I would not listen to dissenting opinions, including when I had my own dissenting opinions. I just looked straight forward. I had my path. I was who I was. And thankfully, recovery has allowed me to go a little bit deeper than to just be the stories that I tell myself.
Well, absolutely. And for our listening audience, again, I'm talking with Joshua Shea, and he wrote a book called The Addiction That Nobody Will Talk About, How My Pornography Addiction Hurt People and Destroyed Relationships, which, I mean, you can't say it any more clear than that. Now, first of all, if people want to get the book, how can they go about doing that?
Well, you can, you know, do the 21st century thing and just jump on Amazon and type in the name of the book or my name. But what I usually try to do is drive people to my website. And that website is recoveringpornaddict.com. There are links where you can buy the book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you know, a few other places. But my website also really is the evolution of that book. It talks a lot more about my recovery. I write a couple articles a week usually. It's what the book isn't. It's the how-to section. It's got resources. It has your statistics. It really is about me living my life in recovery, where the book is more geared towards here's how a guy who seemingly has everything can be successful at hiding an addiction for a long time, but eventually you can't keep up the facade forever.
Well, and actually how that was a blessing in that it got you to look at the things you needed to look at to heal from the wounds that you had in childhood. Now, what was your recovery process like? I mean, I know that it started before you went to jail. So talk a little bit about the recovery process, how it's ongoing, and what it means
to you.
Yeah,
sure, sure. Yeah, well, I met with my lawyer for the very first time the day after that I was arrested. He was a acquaintance of my father's, and my father told him a little bit about me. And, you know, it was not a secret in my family that I drank a little bit too much, but that was about it. And I had no record at all, no legal problems at all before this happened. And like everybody else around here, my lawyer knew who I was and what my accomplishments were even before he met me personally. And he, you know, he also knew that they had me dead to rights when it came to having the proof on my computer that they could prosecute me with. So it really became about sentencing immediately. And he asked, and my wife and my father both came to the first meeting that I had with my lawyer. And it was brought up that, you know, our strategy would probably be to show that this was a sickness, that I, you know, here I am a pillar of the community, but there was something else going on. And what we need to do is figure out what else is going on, figure out how to deal with it, and figure out how I can move forward so I don't ever reoffend like this again. And the first thing that was decided on, almost as a little group, was that I really need to get help for my alcoholism. Because truth be told, while I knew that I looked at pornography probably more than the average person, and I used it in a way that the average person probably didn't, I had not yet. And the shock was probably still fresh from the arrest, but I did not wrap my arms around the fact that I was truly a pornography addict for some time after that. But I knew that day that I had an issue with alcohol, and that I probably needed some help. So I agreed to go off to an inpatient treatment center in California. I thought that I'd be there for 28 days, just like you see in the movies, and I'd you know, act all sad that I had a drinking problem. While I didn't think I really had much of a drinking problem, I just, you know, I drank because of stress and removed the stress. There's no problem. Well, it only took a few days in the facility for me to really understand what alcoholism is and that I was absolutely an alcoholic. And those 28 days turned into 70 days. And they were 70 of the best days of my life and 70 of the hardest days of my life as I came to understand my relationship with alcohol, why it developed, and what it was doing to me. After that, I came home and got myself into one-on-one therapy multiple times a week to start talking in a safe place about the sex issues and how I viewed sexuality and how I utilized pornography. And after 7-8 months of that, I really came to understand that while my alcoholism was probably the public addiction, the porn addiction was really the private addiction, but it was just as big an addiction. And I needed help with that. So I went to my lawyer and said, listen, I think I need to go do this as well. And thankfully, the district attorney was very understanding in this case. And he told me to go get whatever help I needed. And, you know, we would put off sentencing. Well, you know, I couldn't avoid it, but we'd put it off. So I went off to a Texas rehab in Argyle, Texas, for 7 weeks. And that was a very different kind of rehab, but it was still just as important, just as transformational. I came back and continued with the deep one-on-one therapy. Did some 12-step meetings, but unfortunately in Maine, there are just next to none when it comes to Sex Addicts Anonymous. And continued to learn about it and read about porn addiction and sex addiction. And I reconnected with a friend of mine who I knew had issues with it years earlier, and communicate one-on-one about what we'd both been through. The ironic fact is the day that I went for my sentencing, I was probably healthier that day, mentally, physically, emotionally, than I had ever been in my life. The person who went off to jail 2 years after I was initially arrested was such a healthier version of me. And in jail, I, I was speaking to these men and learning their stories, as I had with people in other rehabs, I just realized I needed to write my book. So that was a huge part of my recovery. When I got out of jail, I continued writing. I started up my website, ended up finding a publisher for the book. And I'll tell you what was actually very, very powerful for me, and I know you saw this in the book, was that the first draft of my book I wrote in jail was about 200,000 words. The one in the final draft of the book is 90,000 words. And what that editing forced me to do was to really take a look at what were the important key points of my story and my addictions and my fall, and what were just the other little pieces that I told myself were important but really weren't. And it was so powerful sitting there just having to really just cut pieces of my story out. I know they're there, and I know, you know, had a feeling what role they played, but what I ended up with in this book was really the most important part of my addiction story. And that was hugely, hugely powerful. And so today I still attend regular one-on-one therapy sessions. I, as part of my probation, go to a regular group therapy for sex offenders. And I'll do that throughout my probation. And I, you know, this book has been part of me since I left jail. And now it's just a matter of talking to people like you, talking to newspaper reporters or radio show hosts, telling them my story, because I realized that it's important. It's great that I wrote a book. It was very cathartic. I wrote a book. I hope plenty of people buy the book, but this book has allowed me to meet people like you and talk to people like you who have larger platforms where I can share my story. And I think what I've really come to understand is that's what the important part of this is. That's what's important for my recovery, is telling my story. It doesn't matter if it's in a book or on a radio show or on a blog or on a podcast or wherever it is. The important thing for me and my recovery and for what I think I need to do to, I guess, give back in a way, is to just keep telling my story and let people know what's happening, because it is the addiction nobody will talk about. Like the book says, the statistics suggest that we're facing a pretty mighty crisis here in the next generation or two when it comes to porn addiction. And I want to do my part and hopefully get out ahead of this problem and just let people know that, yes, it's a tough topic. Yes, we're still a puritanical society in a lot of ways, who doesn't want to talk about what happens when the bedroom door shuts or what you just erased in your browser history. but we need to talk about this, and we need to talk about the effects it's having. So I feel like I'm trying to do some good for society, but this process is also still doing a lot of good for me. And this is what recovery, this is what my recovery looks like.
Oh, absolutely. And we so appreciate you doing that, because obviously one of the things that we know about sex addiction is you're only as sick as your secrets. And when you come out and you talk about your suffering and you bring it to the public and you show your own transformation, of which you have made much, and then you help other people, that's really the crux of life. That is what we're here on earth to do. So I believe that sex addiction is epidemic, and unfortunately so many of our young people are really dealing with already that compulsivity where they know that what they're doing isn't right, but they don't know how to stop, and nobody talks to them about sex, let alone sexual behaviors.
No, and one of the things that I didn't anticipate from this is people outreaching to me with my website, and then now that I'm telling this story so publicly. And I had a guy from the UK who was in his early 20s who wrote to me 3 or 4 weeks ago and wanted to know if he had a porn addiction. And I was trying to say, I'm not a doctor, I can't tell you. But his story was one where he sent me to his website. He had one of the most beautiful girlfriends I've ever seen in life. And he was telling me that he cannot get aroused with her anymore. He has to bring porn into the relationship to be able to satisfy her, or to be able to be together sexually. And it's because before he met her, in his teen years, he spent hours a day masturbating to pornography. And that has left a deep mark, and it's hurting his relationship, and he doesn't know what to do. And you know, I urged him to go speak to some professionals and see what he could do, because I don't know what the answer is. But, you know, if there's this one guy who reached out to me with this story, there are probably tens of thousands of guys throughout the world with similar stories that, you know, the porn has wrecked their regular sex lives. And that's only going to keep happening. And it's only going to keep having, you know, warping people's minds and changing the brain chemistry. And the scariest statistic that I've seen recently was that 1 in 3 men between the ages of 18 and 30 believe that they either have a sex addiction or have a porn addiction or have an unhealthy relationship with porn. That's 1 in 3 guys, or 1 in 3 men under 30. Now, if we don't do anything about that, it's soon going to be 1 in 3 men under 40 and 1 in 3 men under 50. And that's if the numbers stay the same. The history suggests that pretty soon it will be 1 out of 2 men under 30 if we keep going the way that we're going. Now, what happens in 25 years if we as a society don't address this? What happens when half the men in this country have porn addictions? What does that world look like? It's better than the world we're in now, but that's where we're headed.
Well, yes, and because we don't talk about sex, and because we don't talk about all the accessibility to sex, people don't understand how epidemic it is. And, of course, you and I both know that there are plenty of men and women who have wanted to stop and vowed to stop, has known that it was interfering in their relationships or in their own sexuality or in their own health or their own safety, but they've not been able to, and they haven't known where to turn. Now, I'm going to ask you 2 questions, because obviously you ended up going to jail for underage porn. And
yeah,
I'm sure our listening audience wants to know, did you have a gut feeling that she was underage?
I ask myself that a lot. And I think, mm-hmm, if I'm going to be completely honest with me or with you, I use the litmus test of did they look sexually mature? And I gave really no mind to whether they were over or under 18 years old. I think it just, I was just at a place where it didn't matter to me at that point. I'm sure that on these websites that I used, if you didn't like the person that popped up on the screen, you could hit the next button and move on to the next person. I'm sure there were people who were over 18 years old who I hit, or women over 18 years old, I hit the next button on because they probably looked like they were under 18 to me. Because there were some people who were 23 and 27 and 40 who, you know, don't look sexually mature. And on the other end of it, there are 13-year-olds and 15-year-olds and 17-year-olds who look absolutely sexually mature but aren't still children. And did I have a gut feeling? I don't know that I actually had the wherewithal to have those gut feelings. As long as they
question and answer. I mean, obviously, that is being caught in the addiction. So do you think that 6 months was an appropriate amount of time to have been incarcerated?
Well, on a very personal level, obviously I didn't want to go to jail. I didn't want to spend one day in jail because it was me.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at it objectively, when somebody does something like I did, they absolutely should go to jail. I understand people with addictions are ill, but I think when you commit the kind of crime that I did, there has to be repercussions. And I'll also mention that jail was a huge part of my recovery because it taught me that there are consequences to my actions, and it really drove that point home. I was always the person who would, I preach this to people, just go ahead and do what you want and say sorry. It's so much easier than asking permission to do anything, because people will say no to you if you ask for permission. If you just go ahead and do the thing and then say sorry, most people will just shrug. And that's not the way the world actually works. That's the way that my diseased mind said the world worked. And because I was entitled and I was special, that's the way the world worked for me. And this was a great wake-up call that that's not how the world works for me, that I'm just like everybody else and I have to follow the laws just like everybody else. As far as specifically 6 months, I have stopped asking myself if that was too little or too much, because what it was right for the judge, and I had to abide by what the judge said. If I always say, if people think that it's too little time, or if people think it's too much time, there are ways to go change the laws and ways to go change sentencing. I could sit with resentment that I was in jail for 6 months, or I could consider myself super lucky for not being there for 5 years. It was what it was, and I accept it, but I don't dwell on it too much. It was what society deemed was correct. So it was what it was, but it was very important to me, although I probably could have got that message in 2 months just as easily.
Well, and, you know, you were so honest to say that you know that, A, it reminded you of the consequences of your behavior, because obviously in addiction, you become more and more invincible, and because you feel invisible, you don't think it's ever going to catch up with you. So, A, you experience the consequence, and then, two, obviously being there really helped you to get your thoughts together, and it's when you did the majority of your writing. So you made it work for you.
Well, and I'll tell you, one of the things that I never thought, and keep in mind, I was in county jail. In Maine, if you are sentenced to less than 9 months, you go to jail versus prison. So I can't really speak to the prison system in Maine. But in county jail, there were a lot of adjustments, but one of the hardest adjustments mentally was the fact that nobody expected anything from me. I was expected to not get in fights with people. I was expected to take my meds when I was told, and that was essentially it. I could pass up on meals, or I could eat meals. They provided them. I could watch TV or not. There was nothing for me to be beholden to. And that was one of the strangest things in the world. Because even in rehab, you have to be at this group at this time. You're going to be eating this at this time, and you'd better eat it. Then you're going to be exercising at this time, and you'd better be out there. This was the first time in my life that I didn't have a rigid schedule and that I really didn't have any responsibilities. And while that probably sounds wonderful to a lot of people, truly having no responsibilities, truly having no schedule, especially for somebody like me, was such a giant shift in my thinking and in my life that it was probably a good thing because they say, you know, jail and prison strips away a lot from you. That was one of those things that I needed stripped away from me. Because I only became responsible to myself at that point. And that was something that had never happened before. And I don't think that's something that could have happened to me on the outside. I was always going to have my mortgage and my kids and my wife and my work and extended family. And there was nothing but responsibility. Having that all taken away from me while I was in jail was, like I said, for a lot of people, it probably sounds relaxing. It was actually mentally draining on me at first until I learned how to adjust my thinking. So, again, jail, I tell people jail was not hard time. The Hollywood made me think it was going to be a whole lot worse than it was as far as, like, violence goes. But it was long time. It was day after day of being with myself, and you either have to learn to really accept yourself and develop yourself into the kind of person that you can live with, or it's going to be a rough, rough time.
Yeah, very good point. And how's your family doing?
We're great, and we're stronger than we've ever been, and that's just a testament to my wife and my kids. I have seen and met so many people who have had their lives and their family lives destroyed by the kind of thing that I did. And thankfully, my wife worked hard to forgive me. My kids worked hard to adjust and understand. Everybody, has moved along at their own pace. But I feel like, and I think that they would agree, that I'm a better father and husband now than I probably ever have been. And, I mentioned earlier when those police came to the door, I thought to myself, oh, my life is over. My life is over. And the truth was, thankfully, my life was over because that was a horrible, horrible life to be living. And I'm able to live a life now that has more meaning. I may only be talking to, dozens of people or hundreds of people on my blog versus tens of thousands like I was with my magazine, but I feel like I'm saying much more important things. I feel like this all, I want to say this happened for a reason, because I think that I like to think this kind of bad thing doesn't happen to my victims for a reason. But what I can do is if I can, through my work now, create a world that has one less victim than I created, then maybe this was all for a net good.
Oh, and that's a wonderful place to end. Joshua Shea, thank you so much for sharing your story. I want to remind our listeners that you've written The Addiction That Nobody Will Talk About, How My Pornography Addiction Hurt People and Destroyed Relationships. You can get that on his website. And one more time, your website is?
It is recoveringpornaddict.com.
That's right. And, of course, you can do it all the other ways, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, whatever. But if you go to his website, it probably makes him just a little more money, correct?
I'm not even sure. My publisher's handling all that. And I've just been told I won't see any check for 6 months. And because this is such a specialty book, don't expect to see much of a check even in 6 months. So I'm not worrying about that, because if this was about money, I would continue doing what I did in, what I did in my past. And I still make money in regular life as a freelance writer and as a ghost writer. You know, so whether I get $2 and $2.20, I don't care.
Right. It matters not. Well, thank you for getting the word out, and keep us posted of other endeavors that you're doing. And I wish you the best of luck, because you really symbolize what recovery is all about. Thanks. Thanks so much.
Thank you. That really means a lot, hearing that. And I also just want to thank you for giving people like me the platform by which to share our stories, because it would be impossible without that. So thank you very much, Carol.
Well, I love talking about hope, strength, and recovery, and you just keep up the good work. You take care.
Thank you.
That was Joshua Shea, and again, his book is The Addiction That Nobody Will Talk About, How My Pornography Addiction Hurt People and Destroyed Relationships. You can get it on Amazon. And we're running late tonight, so I got to go, but I want you to know there will only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself, and we will see you next week for more Sex Help with Carol the Coach. Make it a great week, no matter what is going on, and no matter what you're facing, you can do it. And go to my Sex Help with Carol the Coach YouTube videos to get inspired about your own personal strengths. Have a great week.